That's the word, David. Thank you. Existentialism is what I was looking for.
Yeah. Aha.
Must have been invented by Aristotle. It was a school of Greek philosophy, right? Well, let me explain where we're coming from here. Good morning. It's Tuesday. It's about 9:30, about 25 after, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don, a biochemist and a member of the board of Creation Moments, lives in Garden Valley, Texas, and visits with us just about every Tuesday morning. And these are the mornings if we're paying attention, we learn stuff that you just wouldn't hear elsewhere. Don, how are things out in Garden Valley? The rain's through and you got sunshine, huh?
Raining for the most part. It was still drizzling a little bit, so we could get into the prison without getting too
wet. It's good that you
wet.
Mentioned doing prison ministry. Otherwise, people might assume you were reporting to your parole officer or something, you know? So,
Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily report to the prison, but no. I guess. But anyway, by the time we got out, around 2:30, 3 o'clock, the rain had stopped, the sun had come out, and it was a beautiful day. And that's what we have today.
Now, do you happen to know what the temperature is right now in Garden Valley, Texas?
I do. It's 44 degrees.
Got it right in front of you. David, what's the temperature in East Dakota? Can you tell us quickly?
19 degrees.
Okay. It's 49 degrees in Harker Heights, Texas. We can tell you that because we're surrounded by thermometers.
That's Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that's Fahrenheit. And they don't use centigrade anymore. Centigrade changed to Celsius. Is that right, Don? It used to be centigrade.
Celsius was the fellow who invented that particular scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was centigrade then? We don't use centigrade anymore. It used to be centigrade in Fahrenheit,
well,
now it's Celsius.
Yeah, centigrade is the same as Celsius as far as the temperature scale, but what we don't commonly use, they use it in chemistry and physics, is the Kelvin scale.
Oh, yeah, I remember that word, yeah.
Mm. And the Kelvin scale is basically the centigrade scale, but absolute zero is zero on the Kelvin scale.
Well, that's like way below zero, right? That's like 400 degrees below is absolute zero?
Oh, it's way below zero, yes. Yeah.
So centigrade, now Celsius.
I don't know. We'd have to look it up. It's been a long time since.
Well, this is all coming. It's coming back to me, my high school chemistry here. If the freezing point, which is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, is 0 degrees Celsius, correct?
And that's correct.
And the boiling point of water is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 100 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking that's where the name centigrade, hundredths, come from. It's that range of temperatures from 32 degrees to 212 becomes 0 and 100, so divided by, you have 100 degrees between the two. Why is that important to us?
Because, in order to compare temperatures, if you want to compare temperatures around the world, for example, or even, in your local area, you need a scale, need an accurate scale to be able to say, okay, today it was 44 at 9:30, and yesterday it was, 52 degrees, and so therefore today is a little cooler than it was yesterday.
When did we first have that capability? Because I'm thinking thermometers don't seem to be an intuitive thing. It had to be developed intentionally for a reason, because it didn't exist through most of our history. When did thermometers come into being?
Actually, in the 1600s, they first started to appear, and Galileo Galilei invented a thermoscope in which he had a long tube with water in it, and there was a bulb at the end of the tube filled with air, and then as the air heated up, it would push the water up, and you could see that going up the tube. Now, the problem with that was there was no scale.
Yeah.
And so while you could see the water moving, and it gave some indication of temperature, obviously the higher the water level was, the warmer it was not calibrated, and it was not didn't have a scale, so you couldn't compare one temperature with another. That comparison, the actual scale, didn't come about until we got to Fahrenheit was the first fellow who came up with the scale, and his lower temperature was the melting point of ice, but his upper temperature for the scale was body temperature, which, you know, was 98. It wasn't the boiling point of water at that time. Now, the reason was that medicine was using, you know, relative terms. That is, you'd touch the person's body and you would say, oh, they're warm, or, oh, they're hot. You know, they must have a fever. And that was about as accurate as medicine could do at the time. And so when Fahrenheit came along with the with his scale, then you had some way of actually more accurately measuring the temperature of a person. Not long after Fahrenheit, and that was in 1714 when he derived his scale, and in not long after that, Andre Celsius developed his scale, in which the lower temperature was the melting point or the freezing point of melting point of ice or the freezing point of water to the boiling point of water. And that kind of set the upper and the lower limit. And then
made it functional, which means that a lot of people wanted thermometers for various applications. At what point did we become capable of measuring the temperature of the Earth?
Yes, the temperature of the Earth. I mean, accurately, Fahrenheit was a German, and Celsius was a Swede. So, in essence, the only, back in the 1700s, the only accurate thermometers were those used by those two guys. And of course, you know, other people started using it in the scientific community. But so you got two questions. When did accurate temperatures become available and, compare it from one location to another? And that was obviously back in the 1700s. But the other question was, when did people start writing down? So when did they start writing it down and then taking, you know, a journal or an almanac of the temperatures from around the world? Now, around the world is relative, because the world at that time of scientific endeavor was pretty much in Europe, obviously Germany and Sweden, but Italy, you know, were the centers of scientific investigation and inquiry. And so that's where most of the temperatures in the early part, you know, came about. It was later that thermometers became ubiquitous as we have them today. And now we have all kinds of ways of measuring temperature. And we do it, you know, pretty much electronically with thermal thermistors, and, you know, we can measure
even satellites are up there gauging temperature too in orbit around the Earth. That's a mystery to me. If you're not,
well, and that's infrared, so you get kind of the reflection of the heat coming off the Earth with infrared spectrometry or infrared light. And yes, now that we have satellites positioned at various places around the Earth, we can, and they, you know, you're not going to position a satellite necessarily over an unpopulated areas. I mean, because just for measuring temperature, I mean, these satellites are used for communication and mainly and many other things. But, you know, measuring temperatures became available not that long ago. I think we've got, as the article kind of pointed out, we had 45 years of accurate satellite temperatures. Now, if you're looking for average temperatures around the globe, a satellite is probably your best bet, because you don't have to have necessarily temperature stations all over the world. Although, you know, now we do have temperature stations all over the world, because I mean, like us, for example, for my grapes, I do have a small weather station, for example, that measures accurate temperatures, and it logs accurate temperatures. So I can go back in time and say, okay, what was the temperature this time last year, and log into the system and get the temperature. I could get the temperature range over the growing season of my vines, for example. The amateur weather stations are now pretty ubiquitous. And even in my area, if I log into the system in the same weather station, there are probably 30 or 40 of these weather stations in my local area. And so, you know, nationwide, there've got to be thousands and thousands. Mm-hmm. So now, but that, you know, is it all correlated with a national weather system? Probably not. So you get very accurate measurements of temperature with the satellites, because now you're looking down. You can see the temperature of the clouds, for example, and, of course, see the temperature of the Earth.
Now we're
so a combination of those two would give you a picture of what the temperature might be in a global area.
And we're starting to narrow it down here. The NOAA, it says, shows calculations, temperature calculations, for Africa, Asia, Oceania, and Antarctica to 1/100th of a degree Celsius. And the article says that's nonsense. Well, they go back to 1850 with these temperature readings before there were weather stations at either. That, a lot of that didn't happen until the 1950s. So what I'm asking, I guess, is how do you go back to 1850 and compare the temperatures then with now?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yes, we'd have to ask them why they think, especially to the 1/100th of a degree. Come on, you know, we only now have that capability because of very sensitive electronics and, like I said, thermistors. There was none of that back then. And even in the 1800s, when the first any type of station was going into the Antarctica, you didn't have that. You had a thermometer that your normal Celsius thermometer, but you can't read that. I mean, you can read it to the 10th, but you're not going to read it to 1/100th of a degree. So,
well, but they're telling us that the temperature of the Earth is increasing at 0.14 degrees per decade. You can't feel that.
Yes, and that measurement is based on the satellite data.
Ah.
It's not based on, thermometer data here on Earth.
But that could be the rate now, but over a very short period of time. I mean,
right, over 45 years.
But that's nothing. That's a drop in the bucket here.
It is a drop in a bucket. And if you have, for example, a solar cycle, which is 50 to 100 years or so, and we're in the warming cycle, of course the temperature is going to increase because we're in the warming cycle due to the sun. And all of the temperature measurements and all of these predictions and analyses are trying to say, hey, the Earth is warming up. We got to do something about it. And, you know, it goes back to the climate change agenda and all of this other stuff. But when you actually, you know, look at the data, the true data and the data that makes, you know, sense, you wind up with a little bit different picture, as we've talked about in, you know, in the past. They're trying to say that, oh, greenhouse gases are causing this effect. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've been polluting our atmosphere with carbon dioxide, which is not a pollutant, it's a plant food, and that's what's driving the temperatures. And the last program that we did, we talked about, hey, you know, CO2, or one of the programs, we talked about the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere follows the temperature. So the temperature rises first, and then the CO2 rises. So not the other way around. It's not CO2 that's pushing the temperature. It is the rising temperature that is pushing the CO2. So the next question is, well, if it's not, you know, the burning of fossil fuels that is pushing the temperature, what is pushing the temperature up? And your most logical explanation, of course, is solar activity. So let's just look at the sun and see what it's doing. Well, you know, we have more sunspots. We have more sunspots last year and the year before than we've had in some time. And it's not surprising then that of the recorded recent history, that is within the 45 years, last year is claimed to be a little bit warmer. I mean, a little bit warmer than the year before in any of the previous years. And the close second was in 2016 or, you know, thereabouts. And so you get these warming trends and you get these cooling trends. And, you know, I think we're just in another warming cycle, and they anticipate that we'll reach a crest in the current warming cycle sometime middle of this year, and then things will start cooling down again. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
This,
and if strikes, that happens,
strikes me as being mathematically untenable, unworkable, clumsy, because, well, here's a ridiculous example, I know, but it's kind of my line of thinking now. If it's 100 degrees in New York and 70 degrees in Los Angeles, it must be 85 in Chicago, right?
Yeah, well, you'd have to measure it in Chicago, but that's not
And that's my point. And they're talking about an average temperature. Where is that average? Does that mean that's the average everywhere around the globe?
Well, and you have obviously more thermometers in the populated areas than you do in rural areas, and certainly than you do at either poles. And so when you go to trying to derive these things, you have to make, I'm sure, certain types of some assumptions. And as we've spoken about in previous episodes, we in your urban areas where there's a lot of concrete and asphalt and that type of things, the temperature is naturally hotter because it absorbs the heat, or sometimes it reflects the heat. So you get a heat warming effect in the urban areas, but if you go outside the urban areas to the rural areas, you find that, oh, the temperature's not rising quite so high as in the urban areas. So as cities start growing and start increasing, you'll see more hot spots, if you will, around those cities. But the temperature in the rural areas are normal. So if you overemphasize the temperature in the urban areas, then you're going to overemphasize the effect of any type of warming that the Earth is undergoing. And indeed, one could argue that if the Earth is warming up, and if it's because of man's activities, then let's blame the building of big cities for that increase in temperature, you know, because that is a fact that the bigger the city, the more, you know, the temperature increase you're going to have over the rural countryside type of thing, which, you know, has pretty much remained stable over several years, if not decades.
I'm wondering if we should there be temperature are there temperature regions? I mean, how is science organizing all this data so that it makes sense to us here? I'm seeing a global average, which to me is meaningless. And I've got to tell you a story. I filled in on the early morning show at a radio station years ago, and I went by. There was a point in the 6 o'clock hour where the phone rang, and there was a man on the other end of the line. I picked it up. I was the only one at the station that early hour, and he was ticked. He says, what's the temperature? Where's the temperature history for this day? I get that every day on this program, and you didn't give it to me. What's wrong with you that you didn't relate the history on this day for the last 40 or 50 years? We go crazy about temperature. We exaggerate its importance. I think 98.6 is probably the most important temperature reading we should be concerned with.
Well, from a medical point of view, you're absolutely right, because, you know, if the temperature starts rising in your body, then your body, you know, is telling you that, hey, I've got an infection and I'm trying to take care of it. And one way of doing it is by raising the temperature of your body. Mm-hmm. And that's what started a lot of this, you know, temperature measuring in the first place, was feeling a person's forehead and saying, you're a little warm today, so maybe you should stay in and not go out in the field like, you know, you normally would, because you must have an infection.
Well, we're all fascinated with the future, with the unknown. And so if somehow we can collect data in some arena of information and project what the condition is going to be in 10 years or 50 years or 100 years, maybe that's of some value. But there's so many variables. This seems to me, again, that the logic is flawed.
I have an answer.
Yes?
Ask Greta Thunberg.
Oh, that's right. Well, she's Swedish. She's uh-huh. she's the home of yep. the Celsius.
Celsius.
Of yeah. where Celsius was yeah. born, yes.
Well, I have a question. So are Lutherans typically warmer than, say, Methodists?
No, we run a little cooler.
No, a little cooler.
We run a little cooler, yeah. We tend to be a little cooler. We, you know, for example, if you go into a Lutheran church, you won't find a lot of people clapping.
Mm-hmm.
And standing up during a song, that's a little dicey. Oh, but your Methodist will clap all yeah. just yeah. like it's going out of style at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
Be more than happy to clap.
And it's 85 in Chicago. You're right. Right. Yeah. Well, pardon me if I'm casting aspersions on the science of global warming, but it just seems to be deserved. And we're actually talking about an article that appeared on the Cornwall Alliance for, if you like, information on climate change and the assumptions that we've talked about and some of the silliness. They do a wonderful job of debunking the whole climate change and global warming argument, and it's cornwallalliance.org is what it is. Mm-hmm. Another place you can go is Creation Moments, creationmoments.com. Don, I mentioned, is a member of the board of Creation Moments, and there is a great supply of scientific information there that talks about the biblical story of creation, and that's where we can get reliable information, not so much about global warming, but about how you rationalize that. Where you start with? You start with history, you start with Genesis, and you build the story from there on. And at some point, science comes in and messes it all up. Pardon me, Don. I didn't mean to cast aspersions on you.
Well, I mean, you know, back in the day when, you know, we had Sir Isaac Newton and some of these Fahrenheit and Celsius and Niels Bohr and Einstein. I mean, science was pure earth back then. And yes, okay, there was some political shenanigans going on in London, for example, but for the most part, it was fairly pure, and folks were really honestly looking for answers, and a scientific inquiry was a way of getting at some of those answers. But if you don't take that in perspective with what actually Scripture says, and if you politicize it, as has been done here, obviously, with the climate change policies that the world is trying to force on us, then you corrupt science and you can't trust it anymore. And unfortunately, that is where we are in today's scientific
endeavors. Once money and politics gets a hold of it, it goes right down the tubes, doesn't it? Thanks for joining us, Don. We'll look forward to next week and we'll learn something. So keep up the good work.
Okay. We'll see you next week. So long.